headlines, Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will fulfill its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal once other signatories live up to their commitments. Afghanistan's defense ministry says at least two people have been killed in a Taliban attack in the eastern province of Ghazni. And also in our headlines, the German chancellor demands tougher measures to stem the spread of the coronavirus as Germany's death toll from the disease reach a grim daily record of nearly 600 people. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital town. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, the Iranian president says the possible return of the incoming U.S. administration to the 2015 nuclear deal neither needs negotiations nor takes time.
As I said before, it will take no time for both sides to return to their commitments. It just needs a will. How was the nuclear deal undermined? That illiterate businessman scrawled his signature on a piece of paper. It all happened with a scrawl. He brought some paper, scrawled his signature, and announced that he walked out of the nuclear deal. Now the next person can sign a good sheet of paper. It just needs a signature, and you're back to square one. It is as easy as this. It won't take time, nor does it require negotiations.
Ronnie was referring to U.S. President Donald Trump, who pulled out of the nuclear accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. He urged U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to rejoin the agreement and make up for the harms Trump did to the Iranian nation. Rouhani stressed Iran will resume the full implementation of the nuclear deal once all other parties live up to their obligations. He said Iran's reduction of commitments, including the installation of advanced centrifuges at its Natanz facility, can be reversed quickly. Political commentator Edward Corrigan believes Biden will throw out what he calls Trump's legacy of poison vis-a-vis Iran once he takes office.
If President Biden, soon to be elected and confirmed, he can simply, throw out the Trump legacy of poison and bring it back and have a constructive engagement and signal a break between his administration and Donald Trump's administration and various policies and shenanigans that he employed to basically disrupt things. He creates chaos, and then out of chaos he seeks some sort of opportunity. But the Iranians are still abiding by the agreement. They've only taken a few small steps, which they are entitled to under Section 24 and 34 of the agreement. And they have, at least lukewarm and vocal support from the Europeans, as well as very strong support from the Russians and Chinese. So yes, I think this is a good opportunity for Biden to break a long string of chain of negative events that Donald Trump created, and to put the Iranian government and the other partners with the CJPOA agreement back up to where they were before Donald Trump took over and destroyed the agreement.
Afghanistan's defense ministry says two security forces have been killed in an attack in the eastern province of Ghazni. The ministry says the attack targeted a military base and left three others wounded, and has blamed the assault on the Taliban militant group. The ministry said three militants were killed in ensuing clashes. The incident came just days after the Afghan government and the Taliban agreed to continue peace talks. They began the negotiations in Qatar in September with the final goal of ending the years-long war in Afghanistan. The talks, however, have failed to reduce violence. Less than 2 weeks ago, a suicide attack killed 31 people in Ghazni. It was blamed on the Taliban. Amin Alami earlier joined us from Kabul and gave details about the attack in Ghazni province.
Well, this incident happened in Ghazni, the capital city of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. According to military sources there, two terrorists had planned to launch twin-track bomb blasts on an Afghan army base in Mullah Nuh Baba area of this city in southern Afghanistan. but Afghan forces identified them and opened fire on them. As a result, the driver of one of the trucks that was full of explosives were killed, and his truck was also exploded, and the second driver was escaped.
An alliance of 11 opposition parties in Pakistan has decided to resign from the national and provincial assemblies as part of their campaign to seek the ouster of Prime Minister Imran Khan. Commander Yusuf has more in this report.
These are leaders of an alliance of 11 opposition parties in Pakistan. They gathered in Islamabad to decide their future action plan against the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan. The alliance, named Pakistan Democratic Movement, was launched in September this year to seek the ouster of Prime Minister Khan. The alliance that included mainstream parties such as Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party claims that Khan came to power through rigged elections in 2018. After their deliberations, they decided to use resignation from national and provincial assemblies to achieve their objective.
By December 31st, opposition lawmakers from provincial and national assemblies will hand in their resignations to their respective party heads.
The ruling Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf has a thin majority in the National Assembly. If opposition parties resign, this may trigger a major political crisis in the country.
Opposition does not want Pakistan to enter an era where institutions are respected and independent, and where there is a level playing field. Tell me, how can the opposition say that the government should go home just because corruption era of opposition has come to an end?
Prime Minister Khan's party came to power after the July 2018 elections. It was the first time government was formed by other than the two mainstream political parties. Khan says opposition parties want to see him go since he is not willing to give them amnesty over the corruption cases. But opposition rejects his claim, saying his two-year rule has only brought disaster to the country, both on the political and economic front.
The anti-government alliance is all set to hold next week a major public rally in Lahore, the political powerhouse of Pakistan. While the opposition insists the government has to go, Prime Minister Imran Khan is adamant he will complete his five-year term. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will head to Brussels in an effort to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. Johnson is set to meet European Commissioner Ursula von der Leyen later on Wednesday. The meeting follows months of talks deadlocked over several key issues, including fair competition. Johnson has called the current situation tricky. EU officials have urged London to make compromises, saying they will not accept a deal at any price. Both sides have spoken of a no-deal Brexit if no breakthrough is achieved. The UK left the EU in January. It's now in a transition period that expires at the end of the year. That's also the deadline for reaching a deal on future trade ties. The number of confirmed COVID cases in Europe has surpassed the grim milestone of 20 million as the continent is struggling with the second wave of the disease. Germany on Wednesday reported a new daily record of 590 new deaths in 24 hours. That brings the country's overall death toll to almost 20,000. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has demanded stricter curbs amid the upcoming holiday season to slow the virus surge in her country. Also on Wednesday, Ukraine registered a record number of daily deaths with 276 new fatalities. The country also recorded more than 12,000 new cases in 24 hours. Europe is the worst affected region by the pandemic. It accounts for 40% of new cases reported worldwide in the past 7 days. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes joins us now from Brussels with an update on the coronavirus surge in Europe. Jerome, what details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
I mentioned Germany, and obviously it's clear there that Germany is going in the wrong direction in terms of trying to handle this pandemic. And Angela Merkel, she said in the German parliament this morning that, you know, Germany will not survive the winter unless it brings in more draconian measures in terms of restrictions. Now, we have seen that these measures have worked elsewhere within the European Union. In terms of the transmission rate of the disease, the figures are going in the right direction in many countries. But then when you look at the death toll, I mean, you mentioned Germany's death toll, but also Italy in the past 24 hours, 634 people dying, UK 616, Poland 568, France 491. So these are huge death tolls in any given 24-hour period. So while the transmission rate is going down, as I say, many places, the death toll is still very bad. And one statistic that stands out to me in my mind is Stella Kariakias, the EU health commissioner last week. She says that somebody is dying in the European Union from coronavirus every 17 seconds. So obviously it's a major concern, especially now that we have the holiday period coming up towards the end of the year, and there will be a lot of people congregating, even though the cafes, restaurants and social places are closed in many countries, including here in Belgium. People will be gathering indoors, closely confined spaces during the holiday period, and there is concern then that hospitals will be overwhelmed in January. But look at the situation here in Belgium. I mean, the things have improved, although the transmission rate is still quite high. It's under 2,000 in the past 24 hours, and it was under 1,000 the previous 24 hours. Again, people are still dying from the disease, but we have strict draconian restrictions here in terms of, we have a curfew that runs from 10 p.m. at night to 5 o'clock in the morning, and on average, the police are issuing 265 fines to people who are breaking this curfew. They're being deemed by the police not to be traveling for essential services, and so they get a fine of €250. So quite a large number of people are breaking the curfew, but we have non-essential shops have reopened. However, other sort of very important services, for example, getting your hair cut, that is not happening. They're saying that probably won't happen until January in terms of reopening hair salons and barbers and so on. So really quite strict restrictions in place. A concern that those countries that are lifting restrictions, that they will face the consequences, though, in January.
All right, thanks a lot. Jerome Humes joining us from Brussels. Also, confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. has surpassed the grim milestone of 15 million cases during the deadliest week of the outbreak since April. The seven-day moving average of new cases has also surpassed 200,000 for the first time. The coronavirus outbreak has so far claimed over 286,000 lives in the world's worst-hit country. A record number of more than 100,000 coronavirus patients were also in U.S. hospitals on Monday. The latest figures come as the country struggles to approve the emergency use of a vaccine. U.S. President Donald Trump has come under harsh criticism for his mishandling of the pandemic and downplaying public health measures to halt the virus spread. Well, the United States remains in a schizophrenic state more than a month after its disputed presidential vote. They informally observed the election's so-called safe harbor day, but a huge majority of voters for Donald Trump insists the election is not over. Rami Mazzari has more from Chicago.
November 8th was Safe Harbor Day in the United States, when all states were to have resolved any presidential election dispute, but it's clear the political seas remain incredibly stormy. It's difficult to know exactly what is going on because both sides have so many claims, counterclaims, supporters, and detractors. There are reportedly around 1,000 sworn testimonies alleging election irregularities, and yet no election-reversing smoking gun has yet been produced. Many government officials insist there was no vote fraud, but the nation's top intelligence official, the Director of National Intelligence, just said that all issues of election fraud must be investigated, and only then would we see, quote, whether there is a Biden administration.
Traditionally, when Republicans have brought up these complaints about voter fraud, they have been before an election to try to restrict the electorate to the ones they want. And the media, you know, has traditionally gone along with that. That's like fair ball, you know, excluding millions of people from voting is considered like fair. And what Trump's like doing now is by bringing it up afterwards, it's seen as like putting in doubt a peaceful transition in the U.S. And that's what the super rich really care about.
The constant message from corporate media is that the election is over, yet it's clear there is no such finality for scores of millions of American Republicans. Top pollster Gallup just reported that 83% of Republicans believe that challenger Joe Biden's projected win is not accurate, showing how widespread and firmly rooted are the doubts regarding the vote's integrity. In a historic move, Texas and Louisiana announced they are suing the swing states of Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan, claiming that they manipulated the coronavirus pandemic as an excuse to unlawfully change their election rules. It appears to be the definitive challenge to the executive orders by some state governors to massively and controversially issue mail-in ballots, even though those orders were not checked and balanced with a state legislative vote. The Electoral College votes on December 14th, but Congress doesn't count the votes until January 6th, meaning election disputes seem likely to continue into next year, regardless of Safe Harbor Day. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
A U.S. judge orders the government to partially disclose files related to the 2018 murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The federal New York judge has given the government 2 weeks to release documents it has withheld from the court and to provide legal justification for their non-disclosure. The human rights group Open Society Justice Initiative has hailed the ruling as a crucial victory in addressing the Donald Trump administration's, quote, shameful cover-up of Khashoggi's killing. The Washington Post columnist was killed and his body dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 2 years ago. The incident sparked international condemnations, with the CIA concluding that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the critic's murder. Investigative journalist Max Perry says there have been developments indicating the United States and Saudi Arabia might have colluded in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
The CIA and the administration have seemingly been at odds as to who they believe ordered the killing. You know, Langley has pointed the finger at MBS, while on the other hand, Trump has been very, very deliberately vague as to what the CIA's findings were. And I think that that probably has to do with the fact that we know that it was, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who likely gave bin Salman the intelligence that the U.S. had on Mr. Khashoggi, including his travel logs leading up to the murder. And, it's no coincidence here that in the last few months of the outgoing administration, Kushner has been traveling in the region to the Gulf state kingdoms, including a stop in Riyadh to visit the Crown Prince. It leads one to think, what's going on here? Is he covering his tracks? Did he have a hand personally as a mole? And did he give the Saudis the green light to do this? I think this ruling shows how there are other factors at play going on.
Venezuela's parliamentary elections have given President Nicolas Maduro's socialist allies a sweeping victory. Maduro says the electoral win ratifies him as a leader of the nation. Although the U.S. and the opposition have refused to recognize the election results, socialists have hailed the vote as completely transparent and valid. From Caracas, Peso Silva reports.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has described the triumph of his political alliance in the country's legislative elections as a popular ratification of his presidency. According to electoral officials, the ruling United Socialist Party and its allies secured over 67% of the vote. Maduro said that the country will be benefited by the new majority of socialists in the National Assembly, as now the legislature will work with him in the legal battle against the U.S. sanctions that have crippled the Venezuelan economy over the past few years. He said this election win will be followed by more victories.
Our Socialist Party has regained control of the parliament thanks to the people's votes. Now we'll also win in regional elections next year.
But the Venezuelan opposition has decried the election's outcome. But socialists dismissed the allegation of electoral fraud.
This election fulfills the rule of law and our voters deserve respect. The U.S. claims are totally unfounded.
Many opposition followers did not vote because they don't trust their own leaders, but it doesn't diminish the validity of the election.
Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has won an overwhelming victory in the legislative elections. While the U.S. has denounced the election over fraud claims, millions of Venezuelans cast their votes in support of Maduro's party. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. The term Ul al-Albab in Ayah 190 of Surah Al-Imran means those who possess intellects. Now, the concept of possessing intellect does not mean simple understanding of the signs of Allah. This means that intellect possessors contemplate on the creation of Allah. Now, there are some people who have knowledge about the solar system and understand the order that exists on the earth and other planets. However, they do not contemplate on that and have a scientific look at it merely without connecting it to a higher almighty power. Such people are not considered intellect possessors according to the Quran.
اما ارتباط این رو با اون کسی که میگردونه اینا رو
اول الالباب are those who can connect all these orderly manners to Allah. In other words, the real lob or wisdom is for those who think about the higher power who created this. If people leave their biases, disagreements, ignorance and enmities, then they will be able to find out the true source behind all the creations on the galaxy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Khalaf Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Khalaf Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Inside Israel.
Trust in the Israeli regime is at a low. A new poll shows that the trust in the Israeli regime has fallen to all-time lows. Just 8% of the Israeli public said that it trusted the regime. This survey has been conducted by the Occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds-based Hidush organization and has been taken every year. The survey results highlighted the continued deterioration of the public stake in Israeli institutions, which displays a worrisome pattern for the regime of a growing disconnection between the public and the establishment, and everyone in between. The survey clearly shows that Israelis cannot even overcome their partisan, ethnic, and religious divisions to pull together to keep safe during the pandemic. This year was the lowest rating ever, according to Israeli media. According to the poll by the Hidush organization, in terms of trust in Israel's institutions, a plurality of 36% said they trust the Supreme Court. This, while 11% expressed the same view in the chief rabbinate. Only 4% of Israelis expressed trust in the Knesset or parliament. Simply put, Israelis feel that the entity they live in is constantly in crisis and holding elections, and their leaders are always fighting. Israel is spiraling deep into a moral, societal, and political tremor of large proportions, according to Israeli media. The lack of faith exhibited by Israelis in regime institutions and in each other is leading Israel down the path toward implosion of national identity. These sentiments have always been there since the inception of Israel. However, they've grown and intensified. Furthermore, these feelings are out in the open, and no one seems to be holding back, not the public, and certainly not the regime. This was magnified to the detail in the staunch anti-regime survey that was recently conducted. The survey showed the least amount of support for the regime by the Israeli public since its inception onto Palestinian lands in 1948. What we are witnessing is the collapse of regime credibility and legitimacy in Israel. Common values are eroding. They are being replaced by a value system that places personal freedoms above all else. This is partly why Israeli society has been unable to muster enough social solidarity to support a system of across-the-board restrictions to defeat the coronavirus. But if the fire is discontent by Israelis over the whole system in Israel, surely the regime and the decision makers have added fuel to the fire. On Twitter, this topic was met with curiosity. Anissa says, when the Israelis take an issue of concern to streets, it's the fraud of their prime minister, not the countless war crimes their prime minister ordains against the Palestinians. Faced with symbols over mouth and they don't like to be looted by the regime, yet they keep looting the Palestinians of their everything? Wow. Atkins said, the Israeli Zionist terrorists are on a self-defeating path. Palestine will be free soon. Neri, citing Israeli Democracy Institute, says, only 27% of Israelis trust Bibi Netanyahu to lead the effort against COVID. 61% of Israelis fear for their economic future. Less than 50% of Israelis optimistic about society's ability to overcome current crisis.
I think, you know, we have a fundamental problem in the political system in Israel. And it goes back even to the British times and the pre-state times. And that is that our parliament and our government are based on political parties. Now, every country, of course, has political parties. That's important. But here, you don't elect, you don't have a representative in the parliament or even on the city council, but the whole country is one single voting district. So when I go to vote, all I can vote for is a political party. In other words, there's no candidates. Every political party for the parliament sets up a list of 120 members. You vote, and it's proportional. So if that list gets 50% of the votes, 50% of the people, the first 60 people go into the parliament, and so on. So that, that used to make sense when people belonged to parties. They were socialists, or they were communists, or they were religious, or they were immigrants, or whatever. Today, the parties really don't represent, it's a very complex society, and parties don't represent us anymore. So in a sense, the huge distance between the political parties that have a life of their own and do all their own coalitions and all their own political maneuverings, and the people who are left out. All that's left for us is either to demonstrate in the streets or to vote every few years for a party that we really don't identify with too much, because very few people really belong anymore to parties. And I think that's the fundamental problem here, that distance.
There are several reasons for this historic low trust for the Israeli regime by the Israeli public. First, both the right wing and the left wing believe that their leaders have betrayed them. The right wing of the political spectrum in Israel believe that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu betrayed them because he signed a coalition agreement with his opponent Benny Gantz. The left wing believes that Gantz betrayed them because he joined his opponent Netanyahu and formed the biggest cabinet and regime in the history of Israel. Next, there is the cabinet. There are currently 35 ministers in Israel, and that number will go up to 36 based on a coalition agreement once the coronavirus crisis is over. It is the largest cabinet in history. Israelis believe that this group of ministers is making catastrophic decisions. One that recently stood out is giving the restaurant industry only 14 hours to close down was an untenable imposition. The industry employs 200,000 Israelis and rejected the decision and continued to keep their businesses open. This shows an extremely declining faith in the competence of the new cabinet and declining readiness to obey the rules. The Knesset of Israeli parliament received a lowest trust rate at 4%. Israelis feel that the Knesset is out of touch with voters and is in essence dysfunctional. Its decisions contradict rules made by the cabinet, thus creating an environment of non-compliance from Israeli citizens. For example, the Knesset's coronavirus committee, tasked with overseeing ministerial decisions to make sure they are implemented, overturned the restaurant closures because the data it had been supplied by the health ministry on the sources of COVID-19 contagion simply didn't justify the catastrophic economic consequences. It's starting to look like a dangerous shift for Israel. On Twitter, this topic was met with curiosity. Jackie says, "You'll know it's bad if Bibi cuts a deal with the prosecutors so he can leave without looking like he's abandoning Israel." According to Just, the problem for Netanyahu is that not many Israelis trust him. He exposed himself as low-grade dictator, building a surveillance entity based on COVID lies. He's promising third lockdown already. People are killed in hospitals. I think he dreams for Biden to win. Israelis' trust in political institutions is at an all-time low. Then Netanyahu said that there would be a vaccine in January 2021. Where will public trust sink to?
We're protesting against a process. A very bad process that is happening here, kind of a dictatorship. We see many things that lead to dictatorship, like closing the world half a year ago, all the corona protocols. Shutting us down, like shutting the businesses down. Many people here are don't have money, don't have job. Many people, we don't know what is happening in the hospital. People are dying. We don't know exactly what is going on there.
What's happening in Israel are challenging shifts for Israelis. Israelis are losing touch with their rulers. Furthermore, many political parties involved are in conflict with each other. So one ministry run by one party is overturned by committees of the Knesset run by another political party, thus leaving the public in a tangle and a dysfunctional environment. Every subsector in Israel, from protesters to those who want to pray in synagogues, and from small business owners to big industrialists, angles for advantage over one another, each looking out for its narrow interests at the expense of others, and to the detriment of the common good. It's a dangerous shift for Israel. The electorate or public loses confidence in its leadership, and most especially in an embattled entity such as Israel, where that confidence is a crucial component in national resilience. This is uncharted territory for Israel. Not even a fourth election can get Israel out of this turmoil.
Absolutely. The elephant in the room is, of course, Palestine and the occupied territories. This is something that Israelis try to ignore. It's almost as if they're suppressing this crisis or this fundamental flaw in their whole system and pretending it doesn't exist. A recent poll asking Israelis what their priorities were put the occupation and the fate of the Palestinians in last place, I think eighth place out of first place economy and their environment. But the idea of making peace is not really considered important. So if you've got that situation, and if you're ignoring what the whole world is addressing and is upset about, and your own people, the majority that Israel controls now are Palestinians through control of its occupied territories and its continual expansion. So it's not really addressing it can't be a healthy society if it's ignoring the main issue that's underlying its problems.
Here's the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. Sources close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denied quotes over the weekend attributed to Netanyahu that were very critical of alternate Prime Minister Benny Gantz. Over the last few days, Netanyahu has been telling confidants that giving the premiership to Gantz would be reckless abandonment of the country. Mari Touchfeld, the political analyst of the pro-Netanyahu newspaper Israel Hayyum, reported he believes Gantz is unprepared and unfit to be Prime Minister at this time. Ynet News. Heir apparent to the British throne, Prince Charles, made a private donation to the Paris Center for Peace and Innovation on Wednesday, marking the first time a member of the British royal family has made an official personal donation to an Israeli cause. While donations from the British royal family are usually made through funds and are kept confidential, the palace has chosen to make Prince Charles's personal donation publicly known, though the specific amount donated was not disclosed. I-24 News. Former Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard hopes for Trump pardon before leaving office. Israeli officials are reportedly considering asking U.S. President Donald Trump for a commutation or a pardon in favor of former spy Jonathan Pollard, who is currently on parole in the United States, Channel 13 reported on Friday. The Times of Israel. Man charged with slaying grandfather for trying to stop him from killing a cat. The man's grandfather, 70-year-old Mordechai Ben-Nun, found his grandson committing the act and tried to stop him. There was a struggle and the cat went free, at which point the older man yelled to his wife that she should call the police to report the abuse. He later killed his grandfather.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام كانوا قبل نوح أمة واحدة على فطرة الله لا مهتدين ولا ضلالا فبعث الله النبيين.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, before Prophet Noah, the mankind were the single community upon the fitrah, neither guided nor in error. Thereafter, Allah sent the prophets.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find a very beautiful conversation between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and one of his most knowledgeable students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir gives some very immortal commandments which are full of great ideals, moral standards, knowledge, and wisdom through which any human being can become perfect, can rise to the heights of perfection and be sublime in their life if and when they put them into effect. Now, one of the things which was said in this dialogue is as follows. Imam al-Baqir says, close up the way of conceit through knowing the soul. Get to the rest of the soul through the soundness of authorization. Seek the rest of the body through giving rest to the soul. Come to the rest of the soul through asking for forgiveness from our sins. Seek the mercy of the heart through the praise of Allah, which should be done very much and in private. Finally, bring the light of the soul through the continuity of sadness. And so here, dear friends, Imam al-Baqir is telling us that know the soul, and when you know what the soul is, you will close up the way of conceit and find rest of your body by giving rest to your soul. Be at peace in your soul. When the soul is at peace, the body will also be at peace. And how is it that the soul gains peace? Is by asking for forgiveness from our sins. from being grateful to Allah for all that He has given us? And how do we seek the mercy of Allah? By praising Allah, by glorifying Allah as much as we can, as much as we can remember, and especially so in private. And finally, bringing the light of the soul is by the continuity of sadness, not sadness about our lives, but perhaps sadness that we could have done so much more, we could have done so many more good deeds, and we could have done so many fewer bad deeds. We could have been such better people, and with this sadness in our heart, we then become motivated to become better people in our lives. Beautiful words exchanged between Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and his esteemed teacher, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who's going to talk about today's topic.
So I would like to talk a little bit about the historical conditions that surrounded this great imam and see what lessons we can learn from him and in the struggles that he had to face. Many of the Shia before the imam were practicing a kind of a mixed type of fiqh, where they would be following proto-Sunni elements and also based upon what teachings came to them from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. One of the reasons why the Shia were so in disarray is because most of the knowledgeable people were killed in Karbala. And also after that, among the penitents, the Tawabun, that rose up against the Bani Umayyah. And so, for example, you found that Shias in, for example, Kufa, were following the teachings of the Ahlul Hadith, who were largely based upon the fatwa of Omar. And so you have Hadith, for example, where one person is saying, I went to Imam Muhammad Baqir about wiping on the shoes. You know, for many of our Sunni brothers, where they do wudu over the socks, right, over the leather socks. And the Imam said to him, you don't do this because this is not something that Imam Ali alayhi salam did. What is in the book is in the book, in the Holy Quran, and what they are doing is something that comes after the Holy Quran. And you found many, many cases of things like this, where the Imam explicates and clarifies the fiqh of the Shia. We find, for example, in also things like theology, the Imam is also very, very explicit and teaching the Shia the proper way of thinking on a theological basis. Not only was he knowledgeable and famous for his knowledge among the Shia, but he was also famous for his knowledge among the Sunnis as well. And so you find that in many, many of the Sunni books, they mention him as a source of many hadith. In one narration, he says, sometimes I mention a hadith and I don't say the chain of transmission, but the chain of transmission goes through me, goes through my father, goes through my grandfather, my great-grandfather, up to the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.